And this is why I think you'll see investors, if they do it right and structure things right, they'll go over a period of 10 years and trade a property that might be worth $500,000 to, at the end of that 10-year span, have a portfolio size that might be worth $5 million or $10 million or $20 million.
Financial independence.
Freedom.
Financial picture.
Independent financially.
Financial future.
Financial freedom and wealth.
Financial independence.
Get your fill. Financial independence and long life. Welcome to another episode of Get Your Fill, Financial Independence and Long Life, where we explore ways to achieve those two goals. And today, I'm very excited. We have Brady Slack with us. He's the managing partner and senior tax advisor of High Country Finance, which is a full-service tax and accounting advisory firm helping clients increase profits and pay fewer taxes. That's my favorite thing to talk about. Brady, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks, Christine. I mean, if that's your favorite topic to talk about, then this will be good.
Yes. So do you feel like in general that people are just paying way more taxes than they have to, or is it this sort of like some small community that's paying too much?
Geez, that's actually a really good question. On average, I think the majority of people pay more in taxes than they should. And I would say there's probably a couple of different reasons why, but I think you're probably right. I think the majority of individuals pay more taxes than they should.
And is that because they're too cheap to hire a good accountant?
That might be one of them. I think there's a couple of reasons. One, and first and foremost, because if we're just talking about the general population, I think we have to take into account that on average, taxes are one of those topics that I think it's a little bit taboo. A lot of people don't really understand how they work. And so therefore, because of the lack of knowledge, they have just a little bit of fear when it comes to whether that's the IRS or money in general. So yeah. I think that's probably like the leading cause of why people pay more in taxes than they need to it's an afterthought for them. It's painful, so they don't want to have to deal with it. And then the second reason I think is because, yeah, the majority of people don't put enough resources, whether that would be money or time or attention, into tax planning and investing and working with a professional. I think that would be a close second, in my opinion.
And how about the fear of being audited?
Well, again, I think it kind of comes back to the fear of just not knowing, right?
Yeah, yeah.
If you don't really have a tax plan, you're shooting in the dark. I think people do have a generalized fear of getting audited, but they don't know why. If you were to ask someone, why are you scared of an audit? They've heard the three or four horror stories without realizing that there's hundreds, if not thousands, of different audits every year that take place. It's just a simple, hey, we have a question, help us understand the question, and we're done, right? Yeah. So, again, I think it goes back to just the lack of knowledge.
You know, I've noticed that some tax preparers are also afraid of being audited. And that bugs me because I feel like they're not being as creative. Like last year I paid, I feel like, more taxes than I should have, because I think, and I said, well, what about, why aren't we doing this? Why aren't we claiming this? Well, you know, you're already sort of in that place where you could get audited. Like, but everything I did was real.
Yeah.
I actually spent this money.
It's funny. We actually just interviewed an individual for a position that we're hiring for. And I try, when I'm interviewing, I ask some questions that our clients ask us about certain write-offs or certain tax strategies that some accountants would consider being gray area. And I do it because I don't want to hire someone whose main objective is not to put our clients in the best position possible to pay the fewest amount of taxes possible. And I can gauge whether or not someone is going to work for the IRS or work for my clients by asking some of those questions. And it is sad. There are a lot of accountants who are quote unquote afraid of the IRS. And maybe I'm naive. I don't know. I feel like I've been through enough audits. I've been through enough interactions with the IRS to understand what their objectives are. What do they want to get out of an audit? You know, what things can we do? What things can't we do to not be afraid of an audit? For me, and the thing that I tell my clients is, an audit is sort of like your yearly checkup going to the doctor. I want to make sure things are operating smoothly. I want to make sure that everything that I'm doing is correct. I have proper documentation. I'm not doing anything that I'm not allowed to, you know, and everything is functioning properly. And if they looked at it that way, and if they prepared and planned their tax returns in that way, I think the conversation would be a lot different.
Yeah. So are there general things that the average person can kind of easily do to save some money on their taxes?
Yes, but I think it depends on how they earn their money, right? Yeah, because if we're talking like going back again to, does the average person pay more in taxes than they should? The average person is making their money via W-2, right? And so are there things that that person can do to save money on taxes? Yeah, we can talk about like your simple 401k, maybe your IRA, HSAs, you know, contributing to a charitable contribution, whatever, but we're kind of handcuffed, we're limited, right? So if I go one step further, it's okay, let's invest into real estate with our disposable income. Let's start a business, you know, and small business is one of, if not the single leading factor to financial freedom and wealth occurrence, right? And then we could get into the real estate or the syndications and funds for accredited investors, because those are opportunities to make more money and pay less in taxes.
Yeah. Which, yeah, exactly. I think, okay, so let's talk about, because a lot of our listeners are entrepreneurs.
Yeah.
So they're small business owners, which I feel like small business owners are in the greatest place, or in a great place, to save money on their taxes. Do you agree?
Well, yeah, and I do. I'll kind of go back to what, so the IRS or really any tax authority, whether that be at municipality, on a state level, federal level, or even internationally, other tax authorities, they kind of have two goals or two objectives. The first goal and objective that they have is to raise revenue. That's how they make their money, is through taxation, right? The second goal or objective that they have is to incentivize activity. And so for the topic of our business owning clients, our investors, our entrepreneurs, they are doing what the government wants them to do. And so the government subsidizes that through tax deductions, tax credits, you know, tax treatments. And that's why people complain about the wealthy paying less in taxes, is because they are, but they're also doing what the government wants them to do.
Right.
You know, which is why employees pay a higher percent in tax. They're not doing anything for, they're not providing housing through real estate investing. They're not providing food through agriculture. They're not providing goods or services through business. They're not providing energy. And so the government has to tax them a little bit more because they actually cost them more, you know? Right. So that is, so yeah, our business owners, our investors, our entrepreneurs are always going on an average basis to pay less in taxes because they get subsidized for it.
Yeah. Well, and also small business owners, that's where the majority of new business, new jobs are going to come from, right? That's
the
new commerce. We have to invent stuff, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, Apple isn't not coming out with any new products, so we're going to have
Yeah. Yeah. And they fuel our economy. Yeah. So you're 100% correct.
So why is it? So how about a person? Okay. First of all, do you want to take this in a different direction? Because I'm about to go like kind of wacky creative.
You,
like
you go. I love getting creative. I think the biggest thing, and again, kind of going back to this idea of a W-2, and this might take the direction where you want it to go, Christine, but I have a really close friend and a mentor. His name's Tom Wilwright. And he always says, if you want to change your tax, you have to change your facts. Right. And so that's something that I kind of reverberate is, hey, if you want to pay less in taxes, we just have to do something different. We have to get creative. We have to change your situation. Right. So I think that might lead us into the direction that you might want to go with this.
That's exactly right. So let's say I'm a W-2 worker and I'm just like, man, I'm getting killed. I'm at the absolute wrong tax bracket.
Yeah.
You know, I don't have any kids. I'm not planning to have kids. So I don't particularly need to, you know, save this humongous nest egg for some future heir. I just want to pay, you know, not get clobbered in taxes. So what if I came to you, would you say, well, Chris, why don't you, have you ever thought of starting a small business.
Yeah. Yeah. The transfer from going from W-2 to business owner or independent contractor is probably the one of, if not the easiest ways to get rid of some of that tax, right? Because right off the bat, when we change from a W-2 to a small business owner, independent contractor of the like, now we get to start talking about business deductions. You know, now we get to start talking about writing off all of the expenses that you have that now become ordinary and reasonable for your business.
Yeah.
The home office deduction, your travel, your vehicle, your cell phone, your uniforms, you know, different things like that. We're not really even getting creative at this point. We're just talking about normal business expenses.
Yeah.
Obviously, and that helps because the fewer in, you know, the less income you report, the less tax you're going to pay, right? So that's probably the quickest way. And then I think the next step, and this is where kind of depends on the situation, right? Because you mentioned this individual who doesn't have kids, they have no beneficiaries. So what's the purpose of building a quote unquote empire besides maybe all the additional money that I could use on a monthly basis, right? But then we start talking about, here's what our disposable income is, the leftovers after we've paid ourselves, we've paid for our expenses. What are we going to do with that? Do we like other business? Do we like real estate? Do we like paper assets? You know, do I want to go alternative energies or different things like that? Because then that's kind of where, again, started that growth kind of happens.
Is it as good for a W-2 person to say invest in alternative energy? Is that going to be a great impact for them on their taxes?
Yeah.
Compared to like investing in Apple or, you know, something.
Yeah,
like that.
for two reasons. And I think this is part of the conversation where I'll sound just a little oxymoronic, but for all intents and purposes, don't let the tax tail wag the dog, right? Because we could go invest into energy, right? Which might mean solar wind energy, which is going to bring some tax credits to offset maybe the tax that I'm paying on my high W-2, which is beneficial. But your rate of return on that investment might be lower than the rate of return on average that the S&P 500 has, right? You don't get the tax benefits in the S&P 500, but you do in the energy credits, right? So, and then if we go like oil and gas, you get to write off up to 80% of your intangible drilling costs. For some of my investors, they invest $100,000 and get an $80,000 tax deduction on their tax return, right? So, and again, they do that because they get the write-off, but then in the long run, some of them get some really good returns on the investment from the actual oil production in that fund, right? So if we just go traditional stock market, you might get some dividends, which is portfolio income. It's got a preferential tax treatment. But again, there's no like immediate tax ability with that investment to where I get like a tax deduction or a tax credit, right? But still very viable options.
Yeah. So you have to sort of do the math and figure out what makes more sense. If I pay less, if I get less dividends, but I also pay less taxes, is that going to sort of even itself out throughout the year, whatever?
Yeah. Yeah. Numbers, I can make numbers lie, but numbers typically don't lie. That's what I always tell clients. You know, and then again, don't let the tax tail wag the dog. If you've got an opportunity to go make money, go make money, because we can always figure out what to do with that money and how to save taxes in the long run.
Yeah. So let's talk about real estate, because I personally love real estate.
Yeah,
I'm a real estate broker. I love everything about it, especially what happens at tax time.
I always tell my clients, in fact, I was on a call last week. I've got some brothers in Idaho, and all of them make really good money, and they all invest a lot into real estate. And I always tell my real estate clients, you guys make me look really good, because real estate is one of, if not the best, tax investment opportunity that exists, in my opinion. So let's dive into it. I'm excited to see where this goes.
Well, so every real estate investment, right, has all different kinds of cool things that you can write off. Depreciation is a big one, right? That's like a really great thing that, you know, oh yeah, well, your property may be actually making money in the market, but on paper, oh no, it's just disintegrating, right?
Well, there's kind of, maybe we can break it up this way. When we talk about tax planning, we kind of talk about three different segments. What is the tax consequence now?
Yeah.
What is the tax consequence when I sell or exit? And what is the tax consequence when I die, right? Those are kind of three planning terms. Now, real estate, as far as the tax is concerned now, no matter whether I'm a passive, active, or real estate professional, should not, we shouldn't pay taxes on our rental income right now because of all the deductions, depreciation, how we get to write that off. So on paper, real estate rental should always be a loss, right? Yeah. And if it's not, I'm either absolutely killing it in my rents, which why would I want to sell the property? Maybe I cash out, refinance, and go buy another property, right? Or I don't have enough depreciation because I've utilized it all. I've held the property for a long time, in which case maybe we should look at maybe a 1031 exchange or selling it or something like that, right? Yeah. So that's kind of the, it's a, again, now, no matter what my classification is, I shouldn't pay taxes on my rental income.
Excellent. And that's especially, that's even true if you have, well, let's talk about second home income or second, like having a second home and allowing that to be a write-off. What's involved in that?
Really good question. And a lot of it depends on my usage, right? Because if we look at like, and again, you're the real estate expert, but if you use a second home classification, that might allow you to get some lending preferences, maybe less down on the property, right? But the tax consequence is always going to come down to what is my use. And sometimes I might be limited as to how much rental losses I can claim on a second home if I use that as a second home and have a lot of use of that property. Yeah. So we have to look at specifically how many days are you actually utilizing it versus renting it out. And the tax treatment is might be a little bit different than the lending treatment. So those are a couple things to consider. Same. Right. Yeah.
So actually I jumped over this and it would probably make sense for you to explain 1031 exchange really quickly for folks who hadn't heard of that.
Yeah. Okay. So kind of going back, we'll leapfrog a little bit, but going back to the tax planning segments of what is the tax consequence now? What is the tax consequence when I sell or exit? And then when I die, right? So typically, because real estate is a capital asset, if I hold that asset for less than 1 year, I pay a short-term capital gain, assuming that I make money on that transaction. What I sell it for is more than what I bought it for, right? Yeah. And short-term capital gains are taxed at ordinary income tax rates. If I hold the asset for longer than a year, I pay a long-term capital gains tax rate of either 0, 15, and 20%. Okay. But again, going back to this idea that real estate is one of, if not the best tax investments we can make. Okay. The reason is because we've covered what happens now, but when I sell or exit, there's a tax section called Section 1031 that allows me to take that property and exchange it for a like kind asset of equal or greater value. And in that 1031 exchange, I kind of kick that capital gains tax down the road and exchange my basis into a new property. Okay, so this is really helpful because now when I want to transact the property or I want to increase my portfolio size or get into a bigger asset, I can do so and not have to pay the tax when I get into that bigger asset. I basically take the equity that I have in the property now and use it as the down payment into the property that I want to exchange it for. And I just move my basis into the next property, right? And I can do that. I can keep kicking that can down the road. And this is why I think you'll see investors, if they do it right and structure things right, they'll go over a period of 10 years and trade a property that might be worth $500,000 to at the end of that 10-year span have a portfolio size that might be worth $5 million or $10 million or $20 million because of these 1031 exchanges getting into bigger properties or a bigger portfolio size. Yeah. So that can be really helpful.
But then in theory, if you didn't die and you decided, oh, okay, I'm ready to, I don't want to do any more real estate investing ever again. So now I want to sell everything. How did that, you've now have 50 years worth of kicking that can down the road and it's got to be a pretty big can.
Yeah, and you can get into a situation where You can get caught with your pants down where, yeah, you might owe a large tax at that point, depending on what your basis, your tax basis, your cost basis are in the future of those assets. So it really, like I said, there does have to be a plan around how we utilize these properties and how we structure them, right? Because if we have to take advantage of some of those things, then maybe at the end of that life cycle, we talk about seller finance deals, something that might create a more like an annuity for you to where you sell the property, you still, you know, have a note, you become the bank and you just collect your principal and interest at fair market value over time, which besides maybe some depreciation recapture extends that capital gain over a period of time and could help reduce some of the tax, right?
Yeah.
So there's some options.
Yeah. And I think ideally a lot of 1031 exchange people are just expecting that they're going to die. And then what happens to your cost basis at that point when you die and you leave all this to your heirs?
Yeah. I mean, geez, we're hitting the nail on the head here, Christine. These are good questions. So taking this idea that I've bought property and haven't paid taxes on the rental income because of the deductions and depreciation I get to take on it, then taking into consideration the fact that I've kicked this tax can down the road time over time over time, and I've done 1031 exchanges, I've increased my portfolio size, et cetera, et cetera. At the time of death, so long as though I've structured things correctly, my heirs might not have to pay a tax based on current tax law, right? We're December of 2023. Things could change, right? But based on current tax law, I can then pass that asset or those assets down to my beneficiaries who receive a step up in basis to fair market value. Now, I could have a tax basis of zero. I could have an asset or portfolio asset of $10 million. If I sold it, I would owe the tax on $10 million because my tax basis is zero. But if my beneficiaries receive that at the time of my expiration, their cost basis now becomes $10 million. And they could sell that asset and not have to pay capital gains tax on it. So we've eliminated now when we sell or exit and at the time of death. That can be pretty beneficial to a lot of people.
Absolutely. Someone asked me a question today that I didn't know the answer to, so I might as well ask you, even though I know I'm going boom, boom, boom as far as topics go. We're still on the real estate topic though. So self-directed IRA, you can buy real estate, but could you do that with a Roth IRA?
So whether it's self-directed or traditional, it's still an IRA. It's still the I'll call it a qualified plan. It's still a qualified plan. The only difference is what that qualified plan is investing into. So typically your traditional IRAs are going to be invested into maybe ETFs, the S&P 500, you know, some mutual funds, different things like that. Whereas a self-directed IRA is utilized just a little bit differently, right? So like personally, and the same would go for a Roth IRA. I have a self-directed Roth IRA, and instead of investing into the S&P 500 or portfolio stocks through my Roth IRA, my Roth IRA is actually the vehicle that I invest into crypto. My self-directed Roth IRA is what holds my crypto assets. But I have other individuals that I know of who invest using their self-directed IRA. Again, it's just a simple name change from a traditional to a self-directed, same portfolio, same money. And you can say, hey, I want to invest into these properties through my self-directed IRA or this crypto or this business, whatever.
And it works the same way. So if I take $100,000 out of my IRA and I use it to invest in real estate, I'm not, if that is then worth $300,000, I don't pay tax on that difference, just like a regular Roth. Holy crap, I love it.
That's the idea. Now, the only difference, and this is where, again, this is where we got to run the numbers based on the tax situation. If I use my IRA or my 401k to self-direct the funds and invest into real estate, I don't get the same tax benefits if I could be qualified as like a real estate professional or active investor, because my qualified plan owns that account now, right? I can, like, all the cash flows would go in and out of that that qualified plan. Any appreciation if I, and then whatever I sell it would go into that account, and I can redirect that and resell it. And the only time I'm going to pay the tax is at the point that I take that money out of the account, right?
The initial deposit.
Correct. So, you know, so if I get to 59 and a half and I have to take a required minimum distribution, then I start to pay tax on whatever the value of is of that account, right? Or whatever I take out.
But with a Roth, you wouldn't, because you pay tax when you put it in.
Correct. Yeah.
So then your whole portfolio is growing tax-free.
Correct. Again, you just don't get the benefit of the depreciation, the losses offsetting other ordinary incomes.
Okay.
Yep.
Because it's not happening in your current tax life.
In my
right?
LLCs or on my personal right. tax return, it's all happening in that qualified plan.
Yeah. Okay.
Again, pros and cons based on the situation. We just have to run the numbers and determine which one would be better.
Interesting.
Great question.
Okay. So I thought of another question and then I forgot it. So I need a minute. Okay. Another real estate related question. So when it comes to this idea, like the rich get richer, someone was telling me about a way that you could fund your child's college education, basically by making them an employee in your company, and you pay them the money that you would have paid to the school, and then it's a write-off for you, and they pay a much lower tax rate on it. Is that a thing? Does that work?
It can, right? So a lot of the answers depend on the situation, right? But in some of my clients' businesses, their child or children perform services for their business, whether that be at advertising, marketing, product development, or they're an actual employee doing something in their business, right? Even as simple as cleaning the company car, cleaning the company office, mailers, different things like that. Now, again, the benefit in those situations is they now get to pay that kid a wage. And once they have a wage, they can now contribute to something like a Roth IRA, right? And I think traditionally, people for maybe education savings would use something like a 529 plan. And the 529 plan can be really good, but the downside is I can only use it on qualified education expenses. Whereas in a Roth, I have a lot more flexibility as to what I could use that for, how much I can take out as long as I qualify to take it out.
Yeah.
And so in this situation, a lot of my clients will pay their child, and typically they'll pay that child up to whatever the standard deduction is for a single filer. 2023 is $13,850. And then they'll take that earned income and they'll contribute the max into a Roth IRA. And then whatever's left over, they'll use that those funds to pay for their kids' sports or dance or music or, you know, whatever, new school clothes or whatever. And then that way they're able to write some of that stuff off through the wage that they're paying their child. Again, I prefer that method if you're able to over contributing to a 529, only because I don't know. I could see, you know, in... you know, I've got a 3-year-old and a 1-year-old, but I could see in 18 years, you know, when my child's 21, I could see them not wanting to go to college, or they might want to go to a trade school, become a plumber or electrician, or they might just want to work in my business. Or maybe when they're that old and they have enough money in their Roth, they might want to buy a rental property, you know, but they can't do any of that through a 529 plan. So I think the Roth is a little bit more advantageous in my opinion.
What other kinds of things are you doing to set your own children up for success, like from a tax perspective or from a money perspective?
Well, it's kind of hard because they're 3-in-1. There's only
I know.
there's only say so I have to fight with them on what they want to eat every morning for breakfast. But
you can't say they're working quite yet.
Yeah, so. No, not quite yet. I think like I do have some clients who have kids, our kids the same age, and they have a product or a service that they're selling and they use their kids on social media. And so there is an aspect that they're able to use to pay them.
Yeah.
But some things that we've talked about for our kids, you know, and I think it kind of depends on how we were like, me and my wife were both raised working. We had jobs at early ages. You know, we have lots of family that have different farms and ranches. And so our kids will grow up with a work ethic. And I think that's probably one of the most important things is that they just grow up with the desire to work and work hard, you know, but as soon as we can, we'll put our kids on payroll. We'll talk to him about money and budgeting. And I think being open about what things actually cost and, you know, showing them maybe what your budget looks like. I have a really good friend who is very successful. He's a little bit older than I am, and his kids are, when his kids get into a high school age, he kind of sits them down and he actually takes cash out of his bank account equal to amounts that he makes on a monthly basis so that they can visualize and see, okay, we make X amount of money. And then they can start to take the dollar bills and say, this amount goes to pay for our mortgage. This amount goes to a charitable contribution. This is how much we have to pay for utilities, dance, music, sports, all of your siblings and your expenses. This is how much we invest, and this is where we invest it to, and here's how much is left over. And that, you know, that, yeah, that kind of gets the kid, you know, that kind of gets the kids thinking like, okay, wow, we, here's what my parents do. Here's how much everything actually costs. And now they can quantify in their mind what their dollar is actually worth, you know? And I like that idea. It actually stems from a principle when I was growing up, whenever we'd go to the store and we worked, my parents owned a business. So I learned how to clean toilets and vacuum really, really good from early on, you know, but they would, when we'd go somewhere, whether that be at a store or we saw McDonald's driving down the street, when we said, hey, can we buy this? Or can we go stop here to eat? My parents would always say, well, do you have your money?
Yeah.
You know, and we had to use our money to go buy things. So I think doing things like that will kind of help them curate that asphyxiation with money and business and building and growing and working.
Yeah. And I think it's fairly rare that parents really help kids to understand what money's all about. I mean, I used to do apartment rentals when I first started in real estate, and the kids just, you know, everything was just given to them. They didn't have a concept of value or even like things that I think are important, like negotiating, you know, like understanding. Yeah. No one ever asked me, oh, will you take less for this apartment? Even though, you know, we usually would, you know, it's just, people just didn't ask. So
yeah,
But
I think it stems, and it kind of goes back to what we initially talked about. I think people in general just don't know the value of a dollar. They don't know how a dollar works. And so for them to be able to explain, and quite honestly, I think the majority of people are not good with money. And because they're not good with money, they don't want to open that up to their kids and then have their kids see, wow, mom and dad aren't really good with money. So, you know, we can't pay for this, or they're in debt with that. And because of that, it kind of falls onto the next generation to where they don't understand money. They don't understand the value of a dollar. They don't know about debt and how to utilize good debt. And so it just kind of continues to trickle down.
Yeah. Yeah. You're right. If they do that whole thing where they take the money out and leave it on the table, like, okay, now we have, you know, X amount of money that we have to borrow from you kids, because as you can see, we don't have enough.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You know, yeah, here's our credit card bill. We owe X amount of money. That's embarrassing, you know, and people genuinely don't like to deal with the embarrassment.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, Brady, like, I'm having fun talking to you, but I know you probably have other stuff to do. So, like, what is one question that you wish I would have asked you that I didn't ask you?
Ooh.
Something you want to make sure people understand, either about you, about taxes, about money.
I think if I can do this, anyone can do this. Like that, you know, it's, again, like I, so my dad has worked for the government for as long as I've been alive. My mom's an educator. She teaches elementary school. So when I say my parents owned a business, they owned a cleaning company when I was in middle school and high school for probably 6 or 8 years. And I wouldn't call it a successful business. I think they did okay. You know, I think they made a little bit of money every year, but it wasn't anything great. Yeah. And so when I say, if I can do this, anyone can do this, I really mean that, you know. And my parents are wonderful parents. Like, and, but if I have money questions, I don't go to my parents to ask them about money questions. I have some coaches and mentors who are doing much bigger things than I am that I ask money questions to, right? But you know, the easiest thing is to just start. Create a simple monthly budget where you understand how much money you're making, how much money you're spending, and look at the difference. If you're in a deficit, you've either got to decrease some of your expenses or increase your income. And I'll give you a little clue. You can only decrease your expenses so far. It's much easier, and it takes the right mindset to do this, but it's much easier to make more money than it is to decrease expenses.
Yeah.
But until you get to a point where you then have an emergency savings of at least 3 months worth of expenses, then move on to the next step of finding some simple investments, you know, manage a small stock or ETF portfolio to diversify some risk until you get a little bit more money, then maybe go buy a rental real estate. You know, I would encourage most people to buy a piece of rental real estate, at least one property every year, you know, and you'll slowly accumulate it. But again, if I can do it, anyone can do it. Just, it does take a little bit of time and a little bit of dedication.
And what you said, you know, someone to coach you, someone to help you. You don't need to learn all this stuff yourself. You can call Brady and say, dude, I got some money. What am I going to do? What's the best way to, you know, not be poor when I die or whatever?
Yeah, it's much more expensive to learn from your own mistakes than it is from someone else's. So,
absolutely. Brady, how can people get in touch with you?
The easiest way for people to get in touch with me is through social media. Either connect with me on Facebook, Brady Slack, or Instagram is probably the easiest, at the Brady Slack. I've got a link in my bio, and if you're interested in scheduling a consultation, go to the link in the bio. You can schedule something there. You can learn more about some of the services or some of the projects that I'm involved in, and we can connect through there. Or send me a DM. I'm happy to answer DMs as well.
Perfect. Perfect. And we'll put all those links in the show notes for you listeners so that you can like click right on and connect with Brady now before tax season comes, because it's going to be too late. You don't want to call him in April and say, oh man, I'm screwed. Can you help me?
Yeah. The best time to plant a tree was 20 years
20
ago.
Years ago.
The second best time is now. So
absolutely. Absolutely. Brady, thanks so much for being with us today. I feel like I have to listen to this at least three more times to make sure I got everything, which is great. That's a great compliment.
No, thank you, Christine, for having me on. I appreciate it.
Thank you, listener, for listening. Do you know anyone who pays taxes? Do you know anyone who pays too many taxes? You have to forward this episode to them, because they are going to be so grateful and so happy to hear from you and be like, oh my God, you're helping me to pay less taxes? Oh, you're even better friend than I thought you were. So do that right now. Forward it to five people while you're thinking about it, and they will thank you, and have a wonderful week.